AT&T Threat Track is a roundtable discussion of the latest network security trends and news, conducted by AT&T data security analysts. Complete video of this show is available at techchannel.att.com.
Hello, welcome to AT&T Threat Track for February 2nd, 2017. This program provides network security highlights, discussion, and countermeasures for cyber threats. Today we're joined online via webcam by Jim Clausing. Hey Jim, how's it going?
Going well. Dealing with some ugly weather the other day, but otherwise well.
All right, good. And in the studio here with me today, we've got Matt Kaiser, one of our security analysts. How's it going, Matt?
Pretty good, yeah.
All right. Keeping busy as always, I'm sure. And Manny Ortiz, one of our other, I guess, directors of security. What's going on in your world?
Not much.
It's always challenging in this environment. You never say not much.
That's right. Yeah. I guess my answer should have been a whole heck of a lot.
Right. And I'm John Hogeboom, of course. Just a quick brief mention. We're in a different studio environment today. Please let us know how you like this setup that we've got. Trying it out, and we'll see how things go in the future. But moving along, let's go to the first story. And I think the first story is one that you're looking at, Matt, with some Android VPN apps and a study that was done there.
Yeah, so the CSIRO, which I can get this right, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization in Australia, did a survey of Android VPN apps. And what that means is apps that are advertising themselves as a VPN solution and are also using the Android VPN permission bind VPN service. So they're actually doing, you know, what a VPN app would do, which is tunnel all your traffic through towards some other endpoint. And apparently, some of these apps aren't quite doing their job correctly, and some of them are doing some pretty malicious things. Hmm. So the stats they did collect were on 283 Android apps from the Google Play Store. Okay,
so these are all the official store.
About as official and vetted as you're going to get on an Android device out of the 1.4 total million apps that are in the Play Store. 38% of them were marked by VirusTotal as containing some form of malware, which is concerning, very weird. 18% of apps, and these are all independent statistics, these are not subsets or overlap, these are just independent. 18% don't encrypt at all. They actually just tunnel traffic, you know, just package
like
it with a couple extra headers.
Kind of thing or something.
Yeah, like any sort of regular tunneling that just wraps it with an extra layer of headers, ships it along and gets unpacked somewhere else. But there's no encryption in that layer. So it's more data, and it's being routed specifically, but it's not secure.
Right.
Which is kind of concerning, because the whole point of a VPN is that it's private. So there should be some encryption involved. 84% of them don't tunnel IPv6, which means that if you have any IPv6 traffic, okay, it's going outside of that secure tunnel.
The world still really hasn't gotten on the IPv6 bandwagon, not the entire world. So I don't fault them. I can see a lot of people not doing that right out of the gate. But
would you expect that 66% don't tunnel DNS?
No, right. But well, I guess it depends. But anyway, I'll let you carry on.
Well, we
know that there are a lot of configuration issues that can cause DNS to stay on net versus the rest of your traffic. But
right. So 16% use non-transparent proxies to modify HTTP traffic, and they maybe give some excuse like, we can do a little bit of optimization, your traffic will go faster, but it still means that there's some tampering that's going on, whether it's malicious or
right,
otherwise. 75% of the free apps contain at least one ad tracking library, which I guess is okay, you know, if you're using a free application.
Yeah, I can't think of an app I've installed lately that doesn't have some sort of ad in it somewhere.
For me personally, if you're using like some official brand's VPN service, like we've talked about private internet access before.
Right.
There's, you know, you're paying for their service and the app is just the way to get to something you've already paid for. In that kind of situation, I would be a little more concerned. But if it's just a VPN app that's used for any old VPN you want, or perhaps for a service that maybe you paid for, maybe you didn't. I feel a little bit, it's still a bit odd for me.
Right, it seems a little odd, right?
Yeah. Two of those apps injected JavaScript into HTTP for ads and tracking, which is directly tampering with the traffic passing through your VPN.
Right.
So for me, part of security is making sure that stuff is confidential, but integrity is also part of that three-letter CIA triad that we were all taught in school. And that really bugs me, injecting any sort of JavaScript, because if it's ads, that's one thing, it's still invasive,
right, but JavaScript's
powerful.
Something worse.
It could be anything, it could be part of a the entry to an exploit kit, you know?
Right.
Four of the apps added their own root certificates to do traffic analysis on that traffic as well. So they're actively decrypting things that were encrypted before they hit the VPN, and now they're being unpacked, which is also kind of scary. So the lessons from this survey, in my opinion, are it's hard for users to tell exactly what the VPN app is doing. I mean, this was a funded study. It was great that they did this. They were able to prove that certain things were being done. But most users would have no idea that these sorts of things were occurring. They would assume this is a VPN app, therefore it is doing normal VPN things. It's doing all the things that it promises and nothing else.
Right.
And that kind of bothers me. I think the way that I would go ahead and do this is either choose a VPN app that's provided by your VPN service provider, because they'll actually vet it and say, no, this works with our service, and as long as you trust the service provider, you might be able to trust the app a little bit better than some arbitrary guy on the Google Play Store. Or an open source app like the OpenVPN client, which is vetted and should work with many different VPN services, but isn't tied to any one of them. And again, since it's open source, the assumption is that someone has looked at the source code, or that someone is able to look at the source code.
Right, right.
And then the last thing is to just keep a close eye on the permissions that the app asks for, because that'll sometimes give you a hint. If it's asking for a whole bunch of other stuff that's unrelated to VPN, you should probably not install it in the first place.
But it doesn't even ask for VPN permission,
some of those apps didn't ask for the VPN permission, which is interesting. And they said something, they broke it up into apps that you pay for, apps that are free, and apps that have like in-app purchases. And for some of the ones that were paid, they didn't even ask for the VPN permission, which is super sketchy.
Right.
I mean, app...
It means they're doing something... Like something different. They're trying to do this a different way or something.
So the general idea is just be aware of what you're doing. If you're installing an Android VPN app, which I recommend you do, if you're going to use public Wi-Fi, just keep these sorts of things in mind.
I mean, that's a good point. So when we're talking about VPN services, like why would I even need this to begin with? When you're traveling, like a lot of times you will use your mobile handset in places that are not necessarily the most trustworthy places. So, you know, airport where there might be rogue Wi-Fi hotspots, or even, you know, coffee shops, things like that. Having a VPN service provider, you know, guarantees you some end-to-end integrity between your handset and, you know, hopefully your trusted VPN service provider. So you don't necessarily have to worry so much about somebody in between there with some kind of rogue Wi-Fi intercepting or decrypting. But like you said, you want to make sure it's a real VPN. It's doing what it's supposed to be doing, and encrypting your traffic from end to end in a, you know, secure, strong way.
And not doing anything on top of that.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss the fact that it's not tunneling the IPv6. Now, in some of these, you know, Wi-Fi spots, they may not be providing IPv6, but you know, most of the phones these days come with IPv6 enabled, and you know, a lot of the big services, you know, your Googles, your Facebooks, your, you know, Twitters and whatever do provide IPv6 access. So, you know, you could have some of the things that you're trying to protect, you know, could be going in the clear over IPv6 if your VPN won't tunnel IPv6. Right now, IPv6 is still a relatively small amount of the total traffic, but it's not something that should be ignored.
No, yeah, I agree. I didn't mean to ignore it or dismiss it. You're right. If there was a vendor that did support both V4 and V6, that would probably be preferred, obviously. So anyhow.
I just remembered something else I wanted to add, is that some of these VPN apps, and this is not part of the survey, this is my own experience, some of the apps that do VPN will have a feature called kill switch. That's one word for it, but the whole idea is no traffic passes if the VPN
goes
drops.
Down, right.
Because if that goes down and you're not noticing it, your traffic is now in the clear. So, you know, some apps will provide you the option that if your VPN goes down, all of your traffic stops until a secure connection can be reestablished.
Right.
And I think that would be something that if I was in the market for a VPN app, I'd be looking for as well.
All right. Good points.
You said that these are all free ones that they tested, right?
Some of them are free. Some of them are in-app purchases. So, like, initial download is free, but then you may pay through the service to get the service. Okay. So, like, you use an in-app purchase to get, like, a month worth of service.
Okay.
And then some of them are paid up front. And they do delineate that in the report. The report's really good. If you have the time to read it, there's a lot more detail in there.
All right. All right. So, yeah, I recommend people check that one out if they're interested in that story for the more details. All right. Moving along. Jim, you had the next story here. And I'm not quite sure what it's all about. Something about DVR passwords, a year's worth being published online?
Yeah, this was a story that I initially saw on the Security Ledger blog. You know, we've talked a number of times about, you know, these IoT devices and default passwords and how default passwords are a bad thing. And so some of the folks have tried to fix the problem by either putting a hard-coded password that is set per device at manufacture time based on serial number or whatever, you know, and stick a sticker on the box kind of thing. And another approach that has been used by a couple of vendors at least is a time-based password similar to what we've seen in domain generation algorithms, mm-hmm. but this is a password generation thing, where every 24 hours, the password for the device changes. That kind of, you know, if for somebody who's managing it, if it's a home thing, that doesn't actually make a whole lot of sense to me. How many people are going to plug a device into their home network and then keep track of the, you know, the password changing every 24 hours and have to keep track of, okay, you know, today is February 2nd. What is the February 2nd password? That's the one I need to administer my device. But there are a number of devices where they're using this as an attempt to, you know, avoid the hard-coded password that never changes. Mm-hmm. The problem with it is, if you can figure out the algorithm, you know, figure out how it was seeded, that it's just as easy for the bad guys to figure them out as the good guys. Worse yet, in some cases, the manufacturer has published the daily passwords someplace where users can go and download them. And that's what happened here. I'm not going to talk about the particular vendors because it doesn't really matter too much. But, you know, there was a certain brand of closed circuit TV and DVR devices. And actually, the code appears to have been shared among multiple vendors. But, you know, at least one of these published all of the passwords for 2017 on their website on a certain page that wasn't really too hard to find. And another vendor publishes 3 months at a time. So if you're publishing them out there on the internet, you know, it's just as bad as having a hard-coded one, because it doesn't take anything, you know, really for the bad guys to look up today's password in the list and try that. Try yesterday's, try tomorrow's in case the clock is off by a little bit. So it's, I personally don't believe that this time-based password generation thing is all that much of a step forward, but we'll have to see what other folks think. And even if it does work out in general, you know, publishing them someplace where the bad guys can find them too kind of defeats the purpose. So,
right. Interesting. I did not know that a lot of these security camera DVR systems had these time-based authentication passwords, but I'm aware of this with some other vendor products in other spaces, other embedded devices for networking hardware and stuff that have like this daily password that gets computed, which I thought when I saw it, I was like, this is crazy. Somebody's going to figure out this algorithm and reverse engineer it, you know? So, yeah, I agree with you. This is probably not great, but I could see that this will probably be getting abused by, and probably has been getting abused by, some of these bad actors that are hacking into these devices. So
you know, long story short, and we said this before, if you've got these security camera DVRs, however, I venture to guess most of the people who watch this show or who have these devices are not watching the show. But if they were, I would say, don't expose your telnet port, don't expose your web server port to allow management from the internet side, because that's a lot of these things are getting hacked into because of that. And this is just another case where it's going to make it even easier if you have one of these types of devices that use these types of schemas. So
this is that, you know, that age-old ease of use versus security, right? And it's always that battle of, you know, which one do you give up? You know, do you make it easier to use but then less secure? This falls into that category. And with these things here, you know, I would think that just based on them being DVRs, I would think that you would have less reason. Like, once you have one of these things set up, there's very little reason to go back and muck with it, like muck with settings. Like, once you've got it set up, you've got all the cameras set up and you've got your remote access set up, there's usually no reason to go back and muck with things. Maybe if you had it set up for remote access and somehow you didn't set up Dyn DNS so that the, you know, so that it would always change, so that you, from your remote phone, you could always get to it. That might be the only thing you'd have to go in, like every, like so often, depending on your provider, you'd have to go in and change the IP address. But otherwise, they should be pretty much set and forget, other than having them, which could be a whole nother story that we have in terms of like updating firmware automatically on these things. But setting it, forgetting it, and then just having the manufacturer have some long, complicated password that's on a sticker on the device itself, right?
Yeah, I think those are the best. As long as they don't make it the MAC address of the device, right, which I've seen as well,
based on the Mac
in some way, which again can be computed because that's a narrow space, because you're already going to know the first three octets, blah, blah, blah.
I'm actually reading a book right now about wireless security, and there was at least one vendor of, I want to say cable modems, we'll go with that, not to give away the brand, but the Wi-Fi password back in the day used to be a function of the SSID. So once you had the SSID, you could actually compute it, and there may be like two different ones to try, but guaranteed that was the password, or one of those two was the password. So this stuff happens all the time, and I guess it's because you've got a really low-powered device, you don't want to do too much work to generate the password, or they just haven't really thought it through yet, but it happens kind of often.
It's interesting. People make these kinds of decisions when they're writing their code. Because I guess the layperson, this might seem like, oh, wow, it's a new password every day, and it's really complicated looking. This must be great. But the reality is no, it's not good.
Well, they do things like that because I think they assume it's a source of randomness, or like the most random thing they've got on the box. Like, they might choose the MAC address, which is a little bit better, but not great, because that's still exposed wirelessly too.
Right.
But if they're already doing something random, why not just use that randomness as part of my other random function,
right?
But yeah, doesn't always work out right.
Anyway, interesting. I guess we'll see how this plays out. If there's more news and talk of the Mirais and the Tsunamis and the other types, Lizard Squad types of embedded device malware using these types of pre-computed daily passwords to compromise devices, because Lord knows there's a ton of them out there exposed to the internet. And this is just another, it's almost like a daily backdoor to a certain list of them that have this type of schema. So
yeah, so hopefully they're not going to be too much more of this. But.
Right, right.
But again, if these don't get patched,
and they never will.
This family's going to be on the internet forever, right? Until there's a patch for it.
Right, right. Speaking of bypassing authentication, sounds like you're looking at the next story here, Manny. What's that one about?
Yeah, so this is a story about the bypassing of authentication on unfortunately quite a long list of Netgear routers. So the article that I read was kind of interesting because it's this guy Simon Kennan from Spider Labs. He basically has this little kind of story in the beginning where he has his, it's a Netgear VEGN 2610. And, you know, it's a cold, rainy night and he's, you know, whatever, in his apartment or his house or whatever, he's in his bed and he realizes that his internet just went down, but he can't reset the modem, right, obviously. And so, but he's too lazy to get out of his bed.
to go down right. and actually hit the button to reset it. So he's sitting in bed. He's like, well, what should I do? Should I, you know, should I just sit here and forget about it? Or should I try to, you know, or do I get out of bed and go downstairs, you know, all the way downstairs and hit the button? Or do I sit in my bed and try to hack this thing? Well, you know, as we all know, he went the second route. And, you know, and decided, let me see what I can do, right? So let me go and look at this, because obviously these things have a web interface that's exposed, or at least that he could get to internally, right. internally from first, right? Side. So internal. So he tries to do a little bit of fuzzing, and the first thing he goes after is a little bit of directory traversal. So he tries the, you know, your typical, you know, dot, dot, slash, dot, dot, and then he does the dot, 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 and the dot, dot, dot basically gets him a response back, which is a 401 unauthorized. And it, within the within what he's seeing there, he sees this unauth.cgi with an ID after it. Oh, okay. So he's like, I wonder what this ID actually is. So so he at by this point, his internet actually comes back up on its own, right? So it goes back up. So he's like, well, at this point, I'm already invested in this, so I'm just going to keep going, right? So he goes out and he starts doing a Google search. Let me find out a little bit more about this unauth.cgi. So lo and behold, he finds a couple of articles back from 2014 that are talking about some vulnerability in this script, right? So he basically finds out that there's another, there's a password recovered.cgi that basically if you pass it the ID that unauth gives you, if you pass it that correctly, you'll and end up bypassing the password, and it actually it gives you it prints out the password in clear text for you. Okay. Now, there's a couple of caveats with it. So you have to the router has to be with the option for password recovery has to be turned off. Which, by the way, is the default on these routers. Okay. So password recovery is turned off by default. So if it's turned on, if it's turned on, what ends up happening is it actually it prompts you for the password recovery questions. In which case, then you're you know you're stuck with trying to get past that. But if you're not, if it's not enabled, it basically passes it back and gives you the clear text password. So he ended up writing a script. He calls the script NetGore. So he writes the script, right? And he explains himself that he's not a great programmer. Right, so he writes this program and he tries it and it works. He's got a whole bunch of other netgears, and in the midst of trying it, he realizes, oh crap, I made a programming error in my script. And there's a problem when he passes the ID, it didn't pass it correctly. So he's like, but it worked. How the heck did it work? How the heck did this work? So he finds out that this, this password recovered script, the first time that you call it, it doesn't matter what you pass it.
Doesn't pass in any junk to it.
Right. It will present you with the it will present you with a clear text password. So anyway, so he informs Netgear of the problem, right? And Netgear at first was a little because this goes back to April of last year is when he actually. I think let them know. I'm pretty sure it was April last year. So April last year, he lets Netgear know. So they kind of took their time. They, you know, they said, okay, you know, and he sent them a whole list because he ended up going off and testing a whole bunch of Netgears. So he ended up finding it on a whole bunch of Netgears. And a matter of fact, he ended up finding it on another router, which I forgot to put in here. There was another router that he that Netgear has some sort of association with, and it was actually in that one as well. But anyway. So he informs them back in like April that that there's basically 18 models of Netgear that are, have this exposure. And six of those didn't have the vulnerability in the latest firmware. But so the latest one that was out in six of those, but that still leaves quite a bit. So time goes on and finally, it was finally late last year, I think, that Netgear finally, after him sending a whole bunch of messages, finally releases an advisory. And in the advisory, there were 25 models of Netgears that were vulnerable to this. So Actually, no, I take that back. That was the second advisory. It's the number actually goes up to 31 once Netgear reports it. So it goes up to 31 vulnerable models. And out of the 31, 18 of them right now are patched. So there's still quite a few that are not patched. Mm-hmm. So anybody who's got a Netgear at this point should certainly be going to pull that list down and make sure that you don't have one of the ones that's actually vulnerable today.
So the bug, as I understand it, is exploitable from the local LAN side, or if you've enabled remote access from the outside.
Yes. Yeah. So
you've have remote authentication enabled to really get it exploited.
Right. But the other thing is, if you can push this command out, it formatted, you know, within a browser somehow as a link or some sort of JavaScript, you can do the same thing from outside.
You just need someone to access
it from.
We all know here, right? I mean, how many of these devices do you think have remote administration enabled? It's not the default, but I guarantee you there's a ton of them that have remote. And once remote is enabled, right, then you can basically bypass this from anywhere. And then he goes into, actually there's a link to one of the original exploits. You know, because when he did the Google search on that original exploit, he goes off and there's an article about the guy who had originally figured out that first exploit. And he was talking about like what the badness could be of having this exposed. And we all know, right? So if you have one of these Netgears, he had done this little test where he had set up a basically a malicious DNS server. Mm-hmm. And so he basically sets up a DNS server. So anytime that router reaches out to go to talk to something, it's talking through the malicious DNS server, and he can basically man in the middle and intercept any traffic that's going back to that router. So, I mean, it could get really ugly.
Yes, it could, as we know.
Yeah.
And there's probably, depending on the type of model, there's probably other things that you could do to the device as well.
It makes me wonder, because some routers, and not necessarily Netgear, have like a command prompt built into them. And once you've got into that interface, you can just start pulling down scripts and running them.
Or a web shell type interface to interact with it and whatnot. Yeah. I mean, long story short, if you have one of these Netgears, you should probably look into it, make sure that it is that you apply the patches, assuming the patches are available, and or disable remote administration. I would recommend, unless there's a really important reason you need that enabled, that you do not have that enabled.
And obviously the other workaround is to turn on password recovery.
Right.
So if you turn on password recovery, it also you know, eliminates this as well. So.
Right. Okay. moving along, let's do the internet weather really quickly here. There's not a whole lot to talk about that we haven't already discussed on previous programs. I'm going to kind of zoom in really quickly on a few ports. This is the most pro ports. This is ones that are getting scanned more often than others. 23 TCP Telnet, obviously taking up the lion's share. That's a lot of these devices we've been talking about that get compromised with Mirai or the Lizard Squad or these other types of embedded malware, and they start scanning for other devices to compromise. 5358 is an interesting one. I don't really have a good answer for this one yet, but we'll take a closer look at it in a second. The 7547 TCP is that CWMP, I forget what the C stands for. WAN management protocol. But in any event, there's some exploits. We'll take a closer look at that really quickly. 3389 is remote desktop protocol, which we see all the time. 1900 UDP is simple service discovery protocol used in a lot of reflection attack activities. 6789 TCP is an alternate telnet port for some of these other embedded devices, notably Dahua DVRs are using that as a telnet port. So that's probably why that's getting scanned a lot. Some of these other ones probably are more pedestrian things like Microsoft SQL Server, 1433, things we see all the time, but not necessarily embedded device, IoT type stuff going on there. Web and then NTP. The NTP could be reflection, seeking out reflection nodes for DDoS reflection attacks as well. This is pretty much the same for the most sources probing. I figure we'll just jump right into some of the charts here. So 7547 TCP, the CWMP, this is actually in terms of the number of scan sources scanning, and even the relative volume of scanning is down from what it was back in November of last year. Back around November 26th, 27th of last year, that's when Deutsche Telekom, we did cover that story. They had a bunch of devices, consumer DSL modems or maybe cable modems, I don't remember what type they were, that were impacted by a TR64 request to the CWMP port on the internet side, but it was answering when it shouldn't be. And then it was also had a bug that was being exploited there. And we'll take a closer look at some of that.
I thought the T-Mobile ones weren't actually being exploited, but they were impacted by it.
They were impacted, but it wasn't necessarily an exploit that was allowing the malware to get installed on the device or whatnot. It's just that they didn't parse and handle it properly. But in any event, so we see that this has kind of gone down. There's some periods of more escalated attack here for a couple of weeks, it looks like the past few weeks, where it's been kind of elevated and stayed elevated, but not anywhere near the volume that it was way back when it first started occurring. This is the type, this is from our honeypot. We showed this once before on the show. I just want to point out a slightly different variation. There's a lot of scanning on this just to see if it's answering. These are a couple that are trying to do things that they shouldn't be doing. These are TR64 request patterns. And what they're trying to do is call the set NTP servers function via TR64, which is to try to set what the NTP server settings are on the device. And you can see in the first example here, they're trying to send a exploit that has a backtick, which means basically execute this, and is trying to CD to a directory. It tries to fetch a piece of malware. It sets it as executable with a changemod 777, and then tries to run it. Now, this could be the case where some devices might get this and they don't actually do this, but they might choke on, what the heck is this? This is not an IP address or domain name, and then they have some issue. Or a good device would probably not answer this at all or just ignore it completely. The other thing I thought was interesting is there are some actors out there trying to do set NTP servers, but they're trying to set an actual IP address in here, which I thought was interesting. I did not test whether this IP address actually responds to NTP, but it's one of those things where if you did set an NTP server and it took on that device, that could be a problem because you can do all kinds of things to skew the time incorrectly on that device, which would basically could disrupt communication on it. So notably, we know like GRE, a lot of these types of devices get used in GRE tunnels and things of that nature. If you could take a device, reset its NTP time, get it to skew off, then it won't be able to participate in a GRE tunnel, things like that. So you can do some kind of goofy behaviors here. I don't know if that's the intent or not.
No, I'm thinking back to Jim's earlier story. Maybe you can specify a time so you know what your monthly password is going to be.
That's another, right, that's possible too.
I think it's difficult to skew it all that much. I think NTP has some functions to prevent against that. It's a thought.
Right, right. Interesting. Okay. Anyway, I thought I'd share those. These are collected from our honeypot system. 6789 TCP, this is the Telnet scanning on these Dahua security cam DVRs. This has been kind of trailing off. We were up around 40,000 scan SIPs per hour when we first started to see this, but we're having kind of a normal decay where I guess they're losing interest in this and it's down to about maybe 10,000 scan sources per hour that we see. If you have one of these Dahua DVRs, you should probably, again, I said, don't expose the administrative interfaces like Telnet or your web interface to the internet, and you'll have a much better chance of your device not getting hacked into and being used against your will. And then the last one here is this 5358 TCP scanning. We saw a short period of maybe a couple of weeks or something here, maybe even a month. I can't really eyeball this well. I guess a few weeks, where we had about maybe 5,000 to 6,000 scan sources per hour scanning for this port. Then it went away completely. And then somebody decided, let's go whole hog, and they're really ramped up the scanning the past week or so here. The interesting thing about this, when I look at these devices, it's a lot of IoT-based devices. When we looked at it last time, a few weeks ago, there are a lot of these devices in, I think, Korea or... I'm trying to remember, did I actually say on here?
Korea,
that were these MaxIO based, kind of like a home router type of device. And they have this kind of web shell console. But when I looked this time, there are a lot more in the US. A lot of them are these net surveillance DVRs. Mm-hmm. And this is a very familiar kind of login page if you've ever seen those before. It's just kind of this gray window that shows up. But I just kind of like looked and showed in really quickly. A lot of them are that type of device. So it looks like they're spanning out, grabbing more types of devices. The interesting thing to me is none of these devices have an exposure on 5358. So it's not as though they got hacked via that port and now they're scanning for more, like a worm type behavior. I don't know what they're actually looking for on this port, which is kind of the thing I'm confused about still. And I think we mentioned that last time. I'm not, you know, it is associated with the Windows Web Services for Devices Secured Port API. And there hasn't really been a known exploit for that since about 2009. I don't know that that's what they're really looking for, but I'm not sure. I haven't been able to capture any kind of anything in our honeypot to say that I understand what this is. But in any event, something to keep an eye out if you watch the network traffic hitting up against your network. You're probably seeing a lot of that. If you had samples and you wanted to share them, please let us know.
At the Internet Storm Center, we had asked for some packets for on that port, you know, folks who were seeing that traffic. Unfortunately, most of them didn't have anything actually listening there, so all we got was sins and resets.
Right. But,
right. If somebody's got the actual traffic, you know, actual packets that we could see, that would be very helpful to see what they're looking for.
Yeah, I agree. I would like to see that too. So, anyway, I guess to be continued, that story. See if we can figure out what that's all about. So that's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at attthreattrack@list.att.com. You can also find the AT&T Threat Track program on the AT&T Tech Channel, YouTube, and on iTunes. Please follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @ATTBusiness. I'd like to thank you, Jim. Thanks, Manny. Thanks, Matt. I'm John Hogaboom. We'll be back next week with a new episode. Until then, keep your network safe.
The views expressed on AT&T Threat Track are those of the participants and do not necessarily represent the views of AT&T or any other person or entity.